Good evening, world. Welcome to another episode of the IP Breakfast with attorneys Emmanuel Coffey and Albert Decady. Good evening, counsel.
Good evening, counsel. How are you today?
I'm doing well. So today we'll have a very short intro because we have a guest. Don't forget that this we do not provide legal advice in this program, and also the opinion that we express in this program are ours and input on our employers. Today we'll be joined by a guest. Her name is Elaine Spector. She'll join us momentarily. Counsel, quickly give your greetings to our audience.
Yes, well, we welcome you from wherever around the world that you may be listening in whatever time. And we look forward to spending a good half an hour with you today.
Yes, so Elaine will be joining us in about a minute or so. And our conversation today will be disparity in among women and among minorities in intellectual property.
In the intellectual property space, we've done quite a few episodes on this subject, but we want to bring different voices and different experiences on that subject.
Yes, so as we speak, we are joined by attorney Elaine Spector. Good afternoon, Elaine.
Good afternoon. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
Excellent.
Awesome. We welcome you this afternoon on the IP Breakfast, although it's afternoon, but yeah. I guess we can still have some breakfast.
Yeah. Yes, I'd have breakfast all 24 hours, right?
It's a little late for coffee, but I can maybe have a pastry.
Yes.
So how about tea?
Tea's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Elaine, we want to tell you that our audience is all around the world now. We listen to about 50 countries, and also we are very proud that 52% of our audience are women. Yeah, so we're very proud of that diversity, and we want to make sure we keep it that way. Because the subject that we want to touch in today is really how do we bridge the gap in women in intellectual property, the patent space, and IP in general, and other minorities as well. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Elaine.
So I am a first-generation Greek-American. I live in the Baltimore area with my husband and three kids. They're all teenagers now. So during COVID, it's the first time I've been happy to say I have teenagers. I don't think I'll say that again. So.
Same here. I know. I do feel for mothers who are mothers, teachers, and they have their full-time jobs, and I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, with the young ones at home, this has really been, and it also highlights the disparities in some of the issues that women have when trying to balance work and life. I think, during this time period, women have had more to take care of in the family, and that also affects women advancing in their careers. So that's another important point, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later on. But so my background is, I got my degree in mechanical engineering. I was always good at math. I was very fortunate in that in my senior year in high school, a family friend asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, my dad's a mechanical engineer. My dad didn't think anything else was worth majoring in except engineering, so he could have kind of I don't know if they pressured, but encouraged me to pursue a science degree, which I'm very thankful for now. But I told this family friend who worked at Westinghouse that I really loved the law. I loved analyzing arguments. I liked making arguments. I was good at arguing. And I told him that, and he said, why don't you consider getting into patent law? Because you need an engineering background or hard science background. And it's a niche market. It's a wonderful market to get into. So with that piece of advice, my senior year in high school, I went and got my degree in mechanical engineering from the University of Maryland, with the thought that I would immediately apply to law school. And what's interesting is when I entered into that class, that freshman class of engineers, of mechanical engineers at Maryland, I was one of the only women, I would say, in a lecture hall of about 150 students, there was maybe three women. So statistically, I mean, that was a little, and you know, I didn't mind it, so to speak, having so many men. I had a lot of friends that were men or boys growing up. I was more of a kind of a tomboyish kind of girl. So that's an okay thing, but it was a little bit off-putting to see so many men and not a lot of women. So it was really hard for me to meet other women kind of in my position. So that was a difficulty I encountered very early on. After I finished my degree at Maryland, after 4 years, I went and applied and got into law school. And I went locally to the University of Baltimore. And straight from, actually my second year in law school, I decided to sit for the patent bar. For those who are listening that don't know, and I'm sure most of you do, you just need your engineering degree to sit for the patent bar. I think a lot of engineers don't realize they can get into this field with their engineering degree without having to go to law school to do certain aspects of what we do as in patent law, prosecution and drafting applications. So once I graduated from law school, I went into private practice. There was a small firm in Bethesda, and there was about five attorneys. There were three partners and two associates. And so I think at that firm, it was really a wonderful experience because you're such a small firm and you're forced to take on a lot of responsibility. So at that position, we did litigation, we did trademarks, we did, you know, patent prosecution, patent litigation, trademark prosecution, trademark litigation, trade secrets, anything that came in the door. So within that 2 years of experience, I was taking depositions, I was making sure every piece of evidence got into a TTAB proceeding. I really took on a lot of responsibility, which set me up to do really well when I transitioned into a very large IP boutique. There was a firm, Bernstone, Zwecker & Mathis. This is actually where I know, Albert, you know John Harity. John Harity and I overlapped at Bernstone, Zwecker & Mathis back in the late 90s. And it set me up to really perform well at that firm because I had such a diverse experience. And I was able to do all types of things, trademarks, prosecution, litigation, and same in the patent area. And so I was there for about 7 years, and then just for some firm politics that were going on that time period in the 2004-2005, I decided to move to a general practice firm based in DC. Well, actually their main office was in Philadelphia. But I spent 5 years there at the large GP practice doing mostly prosecution, but also doing some litigation as well. One litigation that I ended up in the Eastern District of Texas, you all know about that forum for 4 weeks when I had three small kids at home. That was really, really tough. And then that experience kind of rethinking my career at that point, because it was really hard to be away from my family for 4 weeks in Texas when my kids were 3, 5, and 7. So I did some soul searching, and an in-house position became available at Johns Hopkins University. So I accepted that, I applied for it, I accepted it, and I worked in-house at Johns Hopkins for 6 years. And so that was a great experience because I was at that point living back in Baltimore. I spent some time in DC, but had moved back to Baltimore. So the commuting that I had done from Baltimore to DC was done. I was just now commuting downtown to downtown Baltimore and working on some really interesting technologies at Johns Hopkins University. And so I worked there for about 6 years. There wasn't, believe it or not, you know, a lot of people go into in-house thinking they're gonna have more flexibility. And I didn't have as much as I wanted. I really wanted more flexibility. And I saw a posting on IP Law 360 about working remotely, reduced hours. And I noticed John's name and I thought, huh, let me see about this job. This sounds like something that would be of interest to me. So I applied, I took the infamous writing test, I passed it, interviewed and then got the job. So I've been there for about 3 years and it's just been a wonderful experience for me.
This is awesome, Elaine. I mean, your experience from high school, you love math, which is a subject that we need to kind of unpack a little bit, because most pupils in the United States tend to be afraid of math. Why do you think so? And should they be afraid of math? I mean, I love math. I mean, the reason I love math is because the answer was the answer. There was no subjectivity.
I'm with you. And I think there is a component of having, we say in our family, the math gene. You know, some people tend to be, math comes easy. And for me, math came very easy. I don't think it's just that. I think you can become better at math. And there's certainly within my kids and seeing how they all, you know, whether they have, we say, this math gene or whether they have to find other ways to get into math. And for my one son, they're all bright in math, but he has to find other ways to understand math than maybe something for me that just came so easily. So some people tend to just get it so easily, and that was my case. And some people work a little bit harder, but I don't think that should discourage someone from getting into math. In fact, my son's high school teacher said he hated math growing up, and that's why he was actually an excellent teacher, because he could teach different ways to learn math for kids who didn't naturally pick it up.
Yeah, the reason I bring this up is because, you know, usually when a kid starts and with this fear of math and the sciences, then that's already a hurdle, and that they will not be able to become a patent attorney, right?
Right.
Because they're not going to go down that track. So that's, to me, there's got to be some work done in that space to for kids not to be so afraid of math. And because it is, math doesn't hurt, really.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And I'm learning that with my one son, my middle child. He has been afraid of math, but he's had some exceptional teachers that have really gotten him through it and is now really doing well. And, you know, not to get into patent law for a hard science, he's tending to lean towards biology. And there's not as much math in biology. There's still some, and he's got a good working knowledge, but he does want to get into sciences. So even if you don't have that natural ability to understand and comprehend high level math, if you get yourself a really good working knowledge of math and then focus in some other areas like biology, I think there's a great way to get into this profession as well.
Yes, great point. Great point there. Coffee, jump in anytime. So you had some litigation, you have prosecution experience, you mentioned trade secrets. I assume there you were probably writing some kind of contracts issue. So which area do you like the best?
Well, I think at the time, earlier in my career, I think what I enjoyed the most was the litigation. I played sports growing up. I'm very competitive. and the litigation really, really, I was very interested. I was interested in winning and winning for a client.
And to bring the adrenaline up, right?
And so, yeah, so my earlier practice, I like that. I also love trademark prosecution. I love trademarks. It is, they're fun. They're fun. They make sense. And go ahead.
And talking about trademark, is that's another area where people without a science background can actually practice intellectual property as well, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So you don't need a hard science background to practice trademark or copyright law. So that's another area. If someone doesn't have that hard science degree, they can still go into IP by focusing in on trademarks and copyrights. A wonderful field. I love trademarks, and they're just, it's so interesting and so practical in the branding part. It's just, you can really get into an invigorating practice for sure.
All right. So, Coffee, I'm not hearing from you. Emmanuel?
Yeah, I'm here. I was on mute. I wanted Elaine to have the time to...
I think you have a little connection issue. While he's resolving that, let me get into the crux of the topic of the day, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with the report that the U.S. Patent and Trademark put out maybe a month or two ago regarding women in patents. It is kind of a first effort to actually look at how many women are actually filing for patents. And I would say that this report was disappointing, to say the least, of the fact that not too many women, although there's a lot of women and some very famous inventors that are women, that women are underrepresented as inventors. Why do you think that is so, Elaine?
Well, I think there are numerous reasons. I know that I'm part of an organization called Intellectual Property Owners Association, IPO. And IPO, the Women's Committee put together, and this is before I had joined IPO, but the Women's Committee had put together a toolkit that talks about the gender disparity in innovation. And that kind of prompted some of the actions at the PTO. And also there was some testimony before Congress on this issue. And I think a lot of it comes down to women not believing that their ideas have as much merit. So they will hold back until it's further developed, or they may think that it doesn't have value. I think that's a big portion of it. There's also
it is kind of a bias, right? And also you kind of tap into that earlier when you said, when you walked into your engineering class, you know, there were probably three women out of hundreds of men who are pursuing sciences. So is there bias that women are not supposed to be in the STEMs, women are not supposed to be inventors, and that bias continues to play itself out?
Yeah, so I think part of the problem is the mentoring part as well, is that women, I mean, there certainly is, when you're the minority coming in, there certainly is, you feel a little bit different than when you're in the majority, I can say that. I can also say there were certain professors when we did group projects that would not even make eye contact with me. I didn't exist. My ideas didn't matter, and I wasn't, I hope that I would be considered a lighthearted person, and I would just, you know, joke about it at the end saying, gosh, like they didn't even recognize that I was here. I was even person. I would joke with my fellow engineering students. But, you know, not everyone's gonna take that to heart. I mean, take it lightly, and they'll take it, unfortunately, more to heart. And I think that will discourage women for sharing their ideas. And I think that also, companies like, because of the studies that have been coming out, I know there are some companies that are implementing, especially IBM, implementing programs to really focus on increasing innovation for women. And they're doing that through mentoring. And they're also educated. educating women and men about these biases that occur. And we as women have these biases too with ourselves. I just went to a webinar where they talked about women being amazing advocates for other people, but not good advocates for themselves. And so that also needs to be worked on. Women need to be advocates for themselves and have that mentoring and support to help lift them up to say, your ideas matter, your ideas are great. Men tend to have more confidence in that area and submitting more invention disclosures saying, oh, this is a great idea, whereas women seem to sit on it longer. So we need to change that in the rate that women are submitting their ideas for consideration on the company level. Some other issues that occur relate to there's the woman who started that company Spanx, Sarah Blakely, and she indicated that when she was looking for someone to patent her her Spanx product, she could not find a single female patent attorney. So I think as we increase the demographics of women and minorities in the IP sector as lawyers, it also helps encourage those who want to seek protection, diverse innovators, women and racially diverse candidates to innovate and to kind of be on that same team.
Right. So when you say, when you said your teachers would not look you in the eye or ask, and I was going to say that you and late Justice Ginsburg have something in common. I think she mentioned that when she was in law school, they never really asked her any question as if that she was not worthy of answering, being able to answer the question. So you weren't.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And there's some of that still occurs. There's still some of that occurs. And I recall times in private practice where I'm not a shy person and I don't have a problem sharing my ideas. Especially in a group of men, I have no issues sharing my ideas. But every once in a while, in fact, this one litigation meeting, it was a room full of men, me and a younger female associate. She was a second year associate. And I shared an idea. It was quiet. Nobody, you know, it was a terrible idea, I guess, in their minds. And they're criticizing it. And then again, you know, maybe through some more discussion, 10 minutes later, a male associate says almost verbatim the exact same thing. And everyone loved his idea. You know, he's an MIT grad and, you know, PhD at MIT. And so his idea was great. And the female associate walked out of the meeting and said, I can't believe that happened. And what I did was I joked about it. I said, I'm glad you liked my idea. I just said that. You know, there's ways to do it, I think. And my strategy has been through jest because I think people can take that better than getting too critical about it. So,
So you mentioned that how women are supposed to, you know, be more an advocate for themselves. But what role do you think that the system has to play? The law firms, I think there's a need to de-bias the system itself in such a way that this doesn't continue to occur to new generation. How do you think law firms can actually learn from this, from your experience and what we're discussing here, to de-bias their system, and so that when a woman or a man or, you know, anybody speaks, that their ideas are valued and listened.
That's a great point. I think a lot of firms are getting into training, and I know that our firm implemented firm-wide training, and a lot of it has to do with implicit bias. There's also microaggressions. We had four different segments that we all had to take to learn about implicit bias. And they did talk about a scenario where a woman was giving her idea and it was taken over by somebody else. And just putting these programs in place to bring an awareness to the people within the firm about how these things happen. I also think that women, and for me especially in my career, having strong male allies has also been really important. For me, especially being at Harity, having John Harity as a strong ally has been huge for me. And he's encouraged me, he's just that kind of person, to move beyond what I would probably, you know, just bring to the table, having me move above and beyond. That's kind of his mantra, moving above and beyond. Because he almost died, and Albert, you probably know, he almost died of a widowmaker heart attack. And I think when you experience that in your life, you really shoot high. And so I think having training in place, but also having a champion for women through programming, you can, you know, at Harity, we've set up some mentoring programs, some groups that help, affinity groups that help each other throughout the, you know, can relate on certain issues where you might have encountered something in a prior career. There's also, through some of these organizations like IPO, I'm part of a mentoring committee where of women, and we get together once a month and we talk about, you know, we have our war stories from when, you know, someone would make partner back in the old school law firm and, you know, they'd want to go to a place that made us feel very uncomfortable. I almost don't want to say it. And what we did, like what did we do when we felt uncomfortable? And for me, did I want to join the old boys club? Did I want to be included? I did. But I wasn't going to go do what they were doing. It was not something. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. But those kind of things need to change as well. These kind of inner circles that men form that exclude women. I think that's also that I would say over my career, that has been something that's probably turned a lot of women away.
Yes, so you've nailed this. You know, the issue of talking about bias is sometimes people do not even want to know that they have biases, that they, you know, same thing if we talk about discrimination or racial discrimination, people say, oh, I don't have any bias, I'm not a racial person, I'm a racist. And, but I think, you know, in terms, when we talk about women, there must be an effort done to actually look at the integral biases or incidental biases that can form opinions and shift the whole, whether your experience is a good experience or a bad experience. As little as you said, you know, if there's going to be a hangout with the law firm, it cannot happen in a certain setting that leaves the women outside, right? So I'm glad that, you know, things are happening in Harity. I know both. I think it's called Harity now, not just.
It's Harity and Harity, but I call it Harity for short. Yeah, Harity and Harity. Okay.
Yeah, and I know both brothers. I know John for a long time, or maybe dated 20 years. Yeah. So I'm glad to see the evolve. You know, what the law firm is doing. I did see something on LinkedIn that the law firm is actually reaching out to do some minority work. And these are very needed, and they're needed across the industry, not just one law firm that's pushing it. I know PTO is reaching out and doing a lot of work as well. The bars have a role to play, and everybody has a role to play. And like Emmanuel and I like to say is that, as long that we leave one segment of society enfranchised, then we are not working on our full synergy.
Absolutely.
Right? And we can't give a full output if there are disenfranchised group. We all have something to contribute, whether it's women, African Americans, Hispanics, indigenous people. We all need to be on the table, and we all need to be able to contribute. And, you know, the groups that had the opportunities before, like you mentioned that, you know, it was based on your father was an engineer, and you had a conversation, an early conversation that led you to this path. And unfortunately, not everybody has that type of mentoring. within their families to guide them.
Yeah.
Does this program, that's what we're trying to do here, is trying to, for those who do not have it, we are your mentors.
Well, you know, we feel the same way at Herity too, and we have numerous programs, and you had mentioned the Minority Firm Incubator, and that relates to specifically to the fact that there's something called the Mansfield Rule, and that was generated a couple years ago by Diversity Labs, but they really want law firms to have 30% of diverse candidates at equity partner or leadership positions within the firm. For the IP sector, it's very difficult because at the go, our industry in the patent segment, actually, I think AIPLA data shows that even including trademarks, it's 80%, over 80% male. And so we are trying to change that number. So we can't meet a Mansfield rule when, for example, we only have a couple of diverse attorneys within the firm. So when Herity and Herity started their diversity initiatives, which is about in 2015, they were a smaller firm. They had 13 lawyers and they were all men, but they did have one racially diverse, an African-American man that was there. And so once John started that, he decided he wanted to change the dynamics, they implemented various programs. And one of the programs is called the Rooney Rule 2.0, where for every candidate that they're interviewing, they'll also interview a diverse candidate, like a one-on-one. The NFL has a rule called the Rooney Rule that only requires you to interview one diverse candidate per position, per head coach position, and you could interview 1,000 white men, and then one diverse candidate, you've met your quota. Whereas at Herity, there's a one-to-one interview between one white male and one diverse candidate. So that has really helped increase the numbers internally.
No, it is encouraging to see that there are efforts being made at different law firms in the industry. Obviously, if the industry doesn't think it has a problem, it cannot fix the problem. So that's why I was talking about de-biasing the system itself. And we have to look at the system and see where it's going wrong and fix it. And I think everybody benefits when that happened. You know, Elaine, when you're having fun, time goes really, really fast. I did not hear from Emmanuel. He was disconnected for a while. He's back online. He's got the last question, but
great.
Awesome. Thank you. Emmanuel? I'm not hearing from Emmanuel again. He seems to be connected. But we don't have enough time to actually unpack all these stuff that are going. But I think this is going to, somebody's going to listen to this and say, yes, I can be the inspector. And that's what we want. That's what we want in our program. And we want to thank the Herity Law Firm for lending you to us today. We hope that in the future that you will be able to participate with us.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. If you want to leave our audience with a contact info on Twitter or your email address, that's
sure. Okay. My email address is espector@heritylp.com. Please reach out if you have any comments or more information about our diversity initiatives.
Thank you, Elaine. And for me, you guys know that you can find me on Twitter @adecady on Twitter. And you can also find Emmanuel Coffee at Coffee Law on Twitter. Thank you for listening today. Until then, bye.